Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, we often find ourselves talking about London Bridge on this show. But really, when you're talking about London Bridge, the question is, which one? The temptation, of course, is to linger on the higgledy-piggledy mess that is the old London Bridge with its towers and its buildings which meet at the top and the chaos going in as people get blown off the sides and so forth. And indeed, that will be our starting point. But we're going to be looking in particular at a later iteration. It's February the 7th, 2014. I'm in Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud.
Hey baby, let me take you down, so we'll play some strange sights and sounds. You ain't never seen the like before, just a stone's throw from your front door. Hey baby, stood out me, see the beats of the air, land and sea. Some creep, some saw down the road, jam rack store.
My heart aches for some far off place.
Well, hello, hello. We're in a church today, which is why there's the slightly hushed, reverential tone to my voice, and there will be to that of Travis Elborough as well, who's with me here at St. Magnus the Martyr Church on the north bank of the Thames, and at a very particular location in relation to today's subject. Hello, Travis.
Hello, Quentin.
We are looking at London Bridge, and the first thing that I've discovered here that I didn't know before is that it's only 10 feet long.
We're standing in front of a model of London Bridge, which is indeed only about 10 feet long. Kind of very, it looks like it's been made out of matchsticks by some diligent soul, but it is a rather beautiful thing.
It is, and I'll tell you what I'd like to do, actually, because we're going to be looking at the history of London Bridge, but with a focus at the middle part of its history, I suppose, is the clumsy way to put this. And we'll come to your book in just a moment, which is really the basis for us meeting. But I'd like to look at this beautiful model, because this is really quite something. And if you've not been to St. Magnus the Martyr before, you need to get along here. The interior decor is phenomenal. It's got that very Catholic feel, even though I think, Travis, it's not a Catholic church.
It's a Wren church from just after the Great Fire, so it would have been a Protestant church, definitely. But it's very, very elegant, with lots of pleasing gold work, shall we say.
And we like a bit of stained glass here, and there's plenty of that in evidence. Because my knowledge of the Christian faith and its iconography is pretty limited, I'm not going to attempt to do justice to what's here, but do come along and have a look. And we're going to focus in on this historical model, and perhaps we'll start at the end of the bridge where we find ourselves now, because, in fact, this location, as I say, is important to the history of London Bridge. For what reason?
Well, what's important about this location and why the model is here is that St. Magnus the Martyr Church stands practically bang next door to the old footway to London Bridge, the original London Bridge. Now, the original stone London Bridge was actually erected by a priest bridge builder, and there's a whole tradition starting after the Crusades of clerics who would fund building of bridges as an act of faith. And Peter de Colechurch raises the funds for the erection of the first stone London Bridge in the 12th century. He unfortunately dies before it's completed, and is actually buried, his body is buried in a chapel at the end of the bridge. And we also have to remember that until 1729 there is only one London Bridge, i.e. one bridge across the Thames up to Richmond. So the only way to get across from the City of London on the north bank where we are to the southern side, to Southwark and Borough and the kind of stews and wildness and theatres and brothels that are located on the south bank, is via London Bridge or by the boatman. So you know, it's a fundamental artery to London, and you know, the bridge tunnels and funnels everyone arriving from the south into London and the north leaving. It has 19 archways, 19 cutwaters, and a drawbridge, and it's an uneven, kind of snaggledy-toothed bridge. In a way, you know, the way that the cutwaters are rather like an American idea of British dentistry. They're kind of like fangs into the River Thames.
The cutwaters, I'm presuming, are these little promontories out at the foot of each arch.
Yeah, the archways that run across it, and you know, it's incredibly narrow. And one thing to do about coming to this church as well, if you stand to the right of it and look down towards the river, which is a building in the way now, but you can see how extraordinarily narrow the original London Bridge was. And also, obviously, it was occupied. There were, you know, houses and shops all the way along it until the 1750s, when they were eventually removed. And some of them were damaged also during the Great Fire, which was why the church itself was built.
Now, I'm going to pin you down a little bit here, because you use the term original London Bridge, and you've said old London Bridge, and you've said De Cole Church. Bridge.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I want to make sure that I'm attaching the right labels to the right things, because this is going to be important as we move on. We know, I think, that back in Roman times, I think, in fact, when the Romans arrived in this part of the world, they found the stubs of a bridge that had been and gone. So when we say the original bridge and the De Cole Church, which names are we attaching to iterations?
Fittingly, in a sense, for London, the history of London Bridge is foggy, to say the least. I mean, some of the documentary evidence of it only really goes back to Anglo-Saxon times, and one document in particular describes the bridge in passing in a witch trial document, and the bridge is the thing which the spellcaster is thrown off of rather than the kind of centre of attention. Probably in about AD 43, when the Romans arrived, they certainly forded the Thames at some point near where our current London Bridge is, though even that is not entirely certain. And there is the possibility that there was a bridge further down the river too. But effectively, by the Middle Ages, there was a wooden crossing roughly where the contemporary London Bridge is, and where De Cole Church built his bridge. Now, De Cole Church Bridge is slightly to the left of the contemporary London Bridge, and the contemporary London Bridge is occupied on the same site that the bridge that, in a sense, occupies the centre of my book, which is the John Rennie Bridge from 1831, is.
We'll be coming on to that intrigue shortly. Lingering on the old bridge. Now, I'm going to call this the original bridge, even though we know it's not.
I think the phrasing is always used, is old London Bridge, with capital O for old, and L and, L and B also being capital. But old London Bridge is the romantic bridge in a way, isn't it? It's occupied. It also, until the 1650s, has heads on spikes shoved onto it. Including, I think the first was William Wallace, the Scottish rebel, as immortalised in the Braveheart film, but also Thomas More, who people will know from history, but also avid fans of Hilary Mantel's novels. His head was also displayed on Old London Bridge. And rather interestingly, from my point of view, More's great book, Utopia, which is about this ideal society, he cited his utopia somewhere in the newfound land, so i.e. America. So there's a sense that More's head ends up on London Bridge, and then a later iteration of that ends up in the newfound land.
Mm. As we look at this model, I'm struggling to find correspondences with the topography of the town as it is now. I know that the river has narrowed because of having embankments installed and so forth. What I'm struggling to see is where the church that we're currently in fits into all of this. And my eye is on the only vaguely religious-looking building in this, which seems to be halfway across the bridge in the middle of the river. That can't be it, sure.
That would have been the chapel, which was formed part of the original bridge. This incarnation of the bridge predates the Magnus de Marta church. One other thing which we haven't really mentioned is that pilgrims travelling out to Canterbury would also have had to travel from the north, would have also had to cross over London Bridge before making their way out. I mean, if you think about Southwark, the Tabard, which is in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, would have been on the south bank. But you would have, I mean, at one point about having a chapel on the bridge was that pilgrims could pay alms before making their way out to pay tribute to Thomas à Becket, the martyr.
So there was more than one kind of toll going on here.
Yes, exactly, and it was a toll bridge. You had to pay to cross it. I mean, the great tribute was you were supposed to pay tribute to, you know, to God and the bridge, and it was a religious fulfilment to do that.
I'm not sure. This seems very, very typically English to me, that you get a bunch of would-be pilgrims assembling in the city of London, and they make it all the way across one bridge and then have to stop for a pint on the other side.
Exactly, yeah.
What else do we know?
Well, it was thirsty work, wasn't it, pilgriming, let's say.
I presume so.
You think about the place of alcohol in religious worship, you know, from the sacrament. You know, I think it's probably paying tribute in its own way, isn't it?
I'm going to remember that next time.
Next time
I need a
drunk somewhere. Yeah.
Now, what have we got going on here? I know some of the quirkier facts, like the buildings met at the top, and I believe this bridge, rumour has it, was the foundation of us driving on the left as we do
yes,
now.
Yes, that's right. In order to facilitate traffic crossing the over. I mean, they took the houses off around 1750.
Oh, that I didn't know.
So
what was left here then? Just the stone buildings? That
they had a bit of a refit, actually. What happened was Westminster Bridge by Labelli, a Swiss architect, engineer, was created in about 1750. And for that reason, Old London Bridge started to look rather archaic with its houses and all the rest of it. So it was modernised. So they took all the houses off, widened it a bit, put little alcoves on it, and updated it for, you know, for the 17th century, as it were. So, you know, there's an element of the thing about Old London Bridge, and someone memorably described it, you know, its narrative is a history of repairs, because it's constantly kind of patched, rebuilt, it's, you know, it's damaged by fire, frost continually, sort of damages the stonework. I mean, one thing about it is that because it had these, you know, these 19 cutwaters and this drawbridge, it would effectively act as like a weir on the river. It would almost block the river, and this is why you had all these you know, fantastic frost fairs, you know, which you have these Bruegel-like drawings of people cavorting on the ice. And really, what does for Old London Bridge is the frost fair of 200 years ago, of 1814, whose anniversary we're effectively celebrating kind of now, was that the damage was so severe to Old London Bridge, they had no choice but to finally agree to sort out a replacement bridge, something which they'd attempted to avoid for centuries, really, and just patched, repatched, as long as they could get away with it.
It looks to me, and I'd never noticed this before, when you say that the bridge is narrow, it looks to me as though that's emphasised by the fact that the wooden buildings here, all of them as far as I can see along the bridge, are half on the masonry of the bridge and half sort of supported by wooden props, which I can imagine must have a shelf life.
Yes, no, the houses, you know, if you think back of a classic kind of image of some, you know, medieval street with its kind of windy arteries, very spindly, that this is what you get. I mean, one of the interesting things about Old London Bridge is that it was considered, for various reasons, one, because of the flowing of the water underneath it, although that was practically an open sewer, is that actually it's considered healthier to live on the bridge than it is in the city, partly because, you know, you can throw the rubbish into the Thames rather than it cluttering up the streets. So at least some of the filth which you would normally have had on a kind of medieval London thoroughfare is less present than it would have been elsewhere. And what happens in a way is that after the Great Fire of London, when this church was, after this church also was erected, the old kind of medieval shape of the city starts to break up, and you get suburban growth because people have fled the city, their homes have been destroyed, and you get a kind of westward drift which starts to come about in the wake of the Great Fire of London. In a way, I mean, one of the great things about Old London Bridge is, you know, as I already said about the idea of it being endlessly patched and botched and put back together and then attempts to modernise it and those kind of rather half-heartedly done, it oddly mirrors the city of London itself. in a way that there's no real great plan. And there certainly was a great plan after the Great Fire of London, that, you know, Wren and Evelyn both had these, you know, these ideas for these, you know, grand new city squares and revamping the old kind of medieval city streets. But they never came to anything because there were too many vested interests and land ownership, and just expediency meant that it didn't happen. So in a sense, our London today still retains some of the kind of Anglo-Saxon street networks. And Old London Bridge kind of exemplifies that. But in 1814, by the time the Frost Fair has done in most of the stonework, the City of London, the Corporation of London, have to, and the Bridge House Estates have to contemplate, finally, building a new bridge. There have been lots of things. There's been lots of plans for new bridges for London prior to that Frost Fair. I mean, one, again, another one which I find particularly interesting is that Thomas Paine, the great revolutionary of the kind of both the American War of Independence and then the French Revolution, after the American War of Independence, comes back to Europe, initially to Paris and then to London, with a plan for a revolutionary new iron bridge. He tours England with his future kind of arch enemy Edmund Burke, looking for sites for location of the bridge, and eventually they hit on the idea that this iron bridge will be erected over the Thames. So Thomas Paine has a plan for an iron bridge for London, effectively. It never gets beyond the prototype, and the prototype is displayed in a pub, the Yorkshire Stingo in Paddington. People pay and go and see this great kind of Iron Age marvel. But unfortunately, the French Revolution breaks out and Paine heads back to France to throw himself back into the political fray, and his bridge is never realised. But there's this tempting idea of, in a sense, one of the founding figures of the American Republic has a bridge for London. And then again, a bridge for London will end up in America.
Well, I'd like to drift outside, I think, and have a look at where this beautiful, to my mind, object would have sat and try and get a sense of what it would have looked like, which I realise is going to be blocked by something more modern.
Londonist Out Loud is available free as a stream at Londonist.com or a weekly download via iTunes. Hit us up on Facebook at Londonist Out Loud, tweet at Londonist Sound, and check out images of our guests via the Londonist Out Loud stream on Instagram.
Well, the attentive ear will immediately notice a difference in sound quality. Yes, we're next to one of the busy thoroughfares here in the City of London. As we step out of the front door, we can see to our right, poking above the office building there, the monument with the flames licking out of it, the source of the Great Fire of London, the starting point of the Great Fire of London, of course, and a popular suicide point for many a long year. And we can see strapped to the side of the church here a piece of timber. What is this?
From Roman Wharf, Fish Street Hill, 1931, this was discovered. So it's a piece of woodwork from Fish Street Hill. I mean, Fish Street Hill, which is just opposite us here, this is working incredibly well verbally, isn't it?
Well, you say opposite, I say right. But as we turn towards the monument, yeah. we can see.
So monument by monument, tube station. Again, you can see, or anyone visiting can see, how narrow Fish Street Hill. Fish Street Hill was the main entranceway down into Old London Bridge.
Oh, right. So you're going to roll down there and presumably then, past the front door.
Yeah, and then you go past the church here and. Where, you know, where this building in front of us now stands would have been the old footpath or, you know, entranceway to Old London Bridge.
Well, that really is insanely narrow.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
If you had a few people milling around and you tried to get two carts past each other in the midst of the throng, you'd run into problems.
It's certainly true.
And that's before we get the buildings which encroached on the space as well. Yep. So, okay, they're going to come in. What, 10 feet, 15 feet?
Probably about that, yeah. People were shorter and lived by the water. So, you know.
What can we say? Well, it's all blocked off here. What I propose we do is mooch around to the left here, go past the bottom of Fish Street Hill, did you say?
Yeah,
And get ourselves onto the bridge. And
we should briefly mention this lump of stone here in the kind of courtyard of... St. Magnus de Martyr Church, which is a chunk of old London Bridge stonework. Now, the bridge we're going to go and visit is obviously the replacement bridge from the 1970s, but So we have the Frost Fair of 1814, which effectively does for Old London Bridge. And after much haggling and a competition and a call for various designs, a design is finally chosen, and it's by the great Scottish engineer John Rennie. Now, John Rennie is...
You say great, and I think I've heard of the name before, but what was he great for?
John Rennie had a hand in practically everything. The ball bearing is one of his. Macadamized road surfaces are also one of his. They didn't claim the credit for it. He did sections of the London docks. He did the original Southwark Bridge and the original Waterloo Bridge. Both also gone. And in about 1820, his design for London Bridge was accepted by the Corporation of London as a replacement for the old London Bridge. Now, Rennie actually had died by the time that it was accepted. He died, and it was his son, also called John Rennie, later Sir John Rennie, and his brother George Rennie, who carried out the building and design work of the Rennie Bridge. In a way, the 1831 London Bridge is effectively Rennie, as in the family Rennie, rather than John Rennie himself. And actually, there's cause to believe that actually his son George probably designed it. If you actually go out to Hyde Park and look at the bridge that's over the Serpentine, which was by George Rennie, you get some sense of what the 19th century London Bridge looked like. It's quite a similar type of bridge.
For those without access to the Serpentine at this moment, could we say what's remarkable about that design?
I mean, to be honest, it wasn't that remarkable a bridge. I mean, it's quite an attractive bridge, but it was a neoclassical bridge of granite, a very monumental construction. When it was completed, and it was opened in 1831, it weighed 130,000 tons. It was the heaviest thing that ever at that point had ever been erected in London. It was built to last. But the problem with it, in a way, was that Rennie designed the bridge in the 1819, 1820. This is before even George Shillabeery's horse omnibuses are running around the city. So from the moment it opens, when it opens in 1831, it's almost immediately out of date. Within 5 years of Rennie's bridge being opened, London Bridge Station opens down the road, bringing a whole wave of new commuters into the city of London and transforming the numbers of people entering the bridge. Within 20 years of it being built, there's arguments about having the bridge widened, which in typical fashion no one agrees to, and there's a lot of obfuscation, and it's finally widened in 1902.
Now let me get my dates straight here, because I want to make sure I haven't fallen down a crevice in history here. We've got the bridge, the old London Bridge, being decommissioned in what year?
Well, work begins on London Bridge in the 1820s.
So this is when the old London Bridge ceases to function.
One thing that does happen is that the new London Bridge, let's just call it the Rennie London Bridge, is built to the right of the old London Bridge, and this is because the City of London don't want any disruption to people coming in and out of the city and down to Southwark and so on, and trade. At this point, there is Westminster Bridge and there is Southwark Bridge, but London Bridge is still one of the main ways of getting into the City of London. So the Corporation of London don't want any disruption. I mean, Rennie himself actually wanted them to close London Bridge, build a temporary bridge to one side, and take the old bridge down before building the new London Bridge. That didn't happen. So what happens is you have old London Bridge is on one side, and a new bridge rises up next door to it in the 1820s, and is finally opened by William IV in great ceremony in 1831.
Now, what you said about London Bridge bringing more people into the city, does that mean we've got commuters as we would know them now?
Yes. I mean, effectively, the arrival both of George Shillabeery's omnibus in the 1820s, and then the arrival of both steam trains but also steam boats on the Thames means that you have the first run, in a sense, of suburbanisation. So, you know, you have people like, you know, Pooter living in Holloway, you know, who travels in on an omnibus to work in the city. So you that whole phase, in a way, of London life starts to begin from the 1820s onwards. I mean, the phrase commuter is an American phrase, and it comes from the New York subway system or train system, and it was about, you know, commutation tickets. And it's W.H. Auden who allegedly is the first person to put it into kind of English usage in his poem September 1939. And another poetic element as well, the London Bridge, the Rennie London Bridge of 1831, the one which ends up in America, is the bridge of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. So, you know, another kind of transatlantic connection there with Eliot, obviously a native of St. Louis.
And you've mentioned the departure, I should say, of the bridge to the States. And, of course, this is the perfect junction. After only 25 minutes of the podcast, to mention the name of your book.
Well, it's called London Bridge in America, the tour story of a transatlantic crossing. But there's quite a lot of London Bridge in London off the book as well. So.
And it's published by Cape, and the paperback's out with Vintage, I think.
It is indeed, on that commercial plug, so yes.
Well, no, I mean, you've been good enough to share a lot of its contents with us. I would say I've had a look at the book, and there's some beautiful photography in there as well, some historical shots as well, so you can get a flavour of each of the bridges. Well, looking up, it's not looking too good. We're about to go onto the bridge. It's one of those days which is both stormy and rainy. There's increased road traffic because of the tube situation going on, which means that we're going to be having more and more cars going past us. It's freezing.
So a perfect London day. Is
perfect,
what
yeah, yes. Yeah.
A very typical London day, apart from the tube strike.
Well, we're going to go to a break and a word from our sponsor, and hopefully we're going to appear in just a moment or two bedraggled on London Bridge.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to a CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
I'm on London Bridge with Travis Elber, author of London Bridge in America. And we're on London Bridge in London, and what a miserable day this is. No, I mean, I'm trying to find something. You know, there are rainy days which feel invigorating.
Yes.
And this really isn't one of those days. To our fore, we can see a number of nondescript buildings. And is that Southwark Cathedral? Oh, no, that...
Southwark Cathedral. Obviously, the Shard to our left.
We've got Pickford's Wharf over there. And I must say, as I was coming to this meeting, I was admiring some of those wharf buildings. Mm. And they're very individual, and some of them quite glamorous in a faded kind of a way.
Definitely. In a sense, the idea of London as being a mercantile river city, with, you know, the wharfs being taking, you know, stuff from, you know, ships sailing around the emerging empire, is the period when Rennie's Bridge is built. It's when England is becoming, and London is becoming, kind of a major naval mercantile power. And Rennie was also, as well as being responsible for the new bridge for London and also the bridge at Southwark and Waterloo, also had a hand in designing several of London's docks. So, you know, that's the period, in a way, when Rennie's bridge is thrown up, is when the Thames is becoming, you know, not just the main artery for a kind of a thriving city, but also the port of London is effectively, you know, the mercantile nautical hub of empire. So the Thames, you know, is packed with trading vessels, which spread out across the entire empire, and that interlay between London and its kind of dominions is all about the docks, and it's all about the Thames. I mean, those names that are so evocative, that are built into the names of docks and the wharfs. that's the period when René's bridge is erected.
So we're talking about 1831-ish there. I'm curious, have we got the kind of filth and the smoke and all that of the Industrial Revolution clogging up the river yet?
It's on its way, put it that way. I mean, steamboats, as I said, have kind of started to arrive on the Thames by the late 1830s. London Bridge Station, opening in 1835-36. So yes, it's starting to arrive, but at the moment it's in that weird kind of in between phase. I mean, iron is the new thing in a sense, and coal is coming. I mean, interestingly, when they built the 1831 London Bridge, the René Bridge, it was built not that dissimilarly to how the medieval bridge, the Peter de Col Church Bridge, was built. Apart from some steam traction engines to pump some water out, very little of this emerging industrial technology was used to build the René London Bridge of the 1830s. That comes a little bit later. So in a way, this is London of the kind of London that Wordsworth talks about it being, smokeless on his Westminster Bridge poem. It's at that weird moment where it's just about to get grubby and dirty. The Victorian industrial hub is kind of on its way. I mean, René's Bridge was opened by William IV, the sailor king, with a great kind of banquet on the bridge. And one of the spectacles of the opening of the bridge was a character called Mr. Green, who's one of the earliest balloonists. And he had like a coal-powered balloon, coal-smoke-powered balloon, which floated out over the proceedings. Now, Green had a scheme to try and fly a balloon to America, which unfortunately floundered for lack of a backer. But this is this at that point. It's this odd, it's a very slightly steampunk moment, shall we say. We still have all the kind of curlicues of the Georgian society, and the Victorian age is just about to kind of arrive, and with it the kind of vigour of full-on industrialisation. The rocket and railways and that had already kind of were on their way and on the march.
So this is engineering excellence combining really with kind of big ideas and a sense of exuberance and confidence and vision.
Yes, very much. I mean, René's design was a neoclassical bridge. It's a very elegant design. When you see photographs of it in situ from the 20th century, it tends to look a bit dowdy, but actually, having visited it in the States in its new home, you can see that it was actually a rather elegant design. But it's I think one of the interesting things is that because it was a commuter's bridge, it becomes just part of the fabric of the city and therefore easy in a way to ignore. I mean, René's Waterloo Bridge, which was demolished in the 1930s, was always regarded as a more elegant bridge by comparison, and the 1831 London Bridge by René was considered a bit dull, but elegant but a bit dull.
There's a name that I associate with that period, which now I'm going to reveal ignorance if I'm missing something important here. But Brunel, of course, we associate with working with those materials and with bridges as well, of course.
Definitely.
Do we have a Brunel bridge? Have we had a Brunel bridge in London?
Not in London. No, we do have the Thames Tunnel, which Brunel.
Right. So Brunel's London.
Yeah. So I mean, that's Brunel's contribution to some of the river work. Brunel was around, his father was a very near contemporary of René, and then obviously Isambard King of Brunel, who obviously died very young.
I didn't know that. How old was he?
Something I can't quite remember. I mean, he wasn't very old. He pretty much exhausted himself through work. He is the coming man, in a sense, of this period.
Well, we should start drifting across, and of course we've been talking a lot about the trip to America made by this bridge that we've been discussing. And well, anybody who knows anything about that story knows that some stupid American allegedly bought the bridge thinking it was an entirely different bridge. So I almost want to start there, but well, I suppose we should
roll back a little bit. Effectively, the René Bridge, it's widened in 1902, and pretty much that it remains as it is for the next 50 years, 50 or getting on for 60 years. And by the 1960s, as I said, it weighed 130,000 tons of granite. It's the heaviest thing in London that's ever been built. By the mid-60s, it's sinking by an eighth of an inch of a year into the Thames. But also by the 60s, you've got these bold plans for building new roads and ring roads through London. You know, schemes, in a sense, which would have meant the demolition of Covent Garden, having motorways run through Greenwich. This new era of planning for cities.
Well, it's got to be said as well that a huge spate of bridge building going on in the 30s around that time, wasn't it?
Definitely, yeah. In part because the removal of the old London Bridge meant that many of the other bridges had to be gradually replaced, because the Thames, having after embankment, was moving at a faster and narrower rate, and therefore did more damage to the existing bridges. I mean, Waterloo Bridge, the demolition for that starts in the 30s. It's slightly delayed by the outbreak of the Second World War, and it's kind of fully opened by the end of the war. And most of the work on that, as people may know, was done by women, because men were away fighting, which is why it has the kind of images of women on the bridge itself.
Can we linger on that fact, because that seems an overlooked item.
It is.
Waterloo Bridge was built.
Well, a lot of the construction work on it, the final construction of it, was done by women, because it was done at a point when the Second World War, and therefore there was a shortage of kind of male labour.
That really excites me as an idea. We don't hear enough about that, I think.
Probably not. No, and we should.
Well, we really have regressed then, haven't we? Because you don't see very many women on building sites, and yet they put up one of the most notable structures in our city. Okay, anyway, you were saying. We're talking about regeneration and city planning.
Yeah. I mean, in the 1960s, you have a kind of almost a kind of mania for planning, rebuilding, and recreation. An urge, in a sense, to be rid of the bomb dust of the Second World War. And with that comes things like the destruction of the Euston Arch, where the sort of Hardwick's huge entranceway to Euston Station is demolished, and most of it dumped into the River Lee, in the British Transport Commission's plans to redevelop Euston Station, turning it into something that looks a bit more like an airport terminal rather than a centre of steam travel, shall we say. So there's an urge to remake the city and make it new, and very little of old London, in a way, isn't earmarked for some form of demolition or rebuilding, and London Bridge isn't immune from that. So in the mid-60s, the Corporation of London announced plans to build a new bridge for London, and that's what they did. They employ a character called William Holford, who was also responsible for the rebuilding of Paternoster Square by St Paul's, and also Holford also had a plan for a reconstruction of Piccadilly Circus, where Piccadilly Circus would effectively be raised above a kind of motorway, and Eros would be on a flower shop on a kind of odd pedestal. The plans didn't come to anything in the end.
Have you seen these plans?
I have. Yes.
What do you think of them?
They're not incredibly inspiring. I mean, they're very of that time. They're rather like, I mean, they're classic sort of 1960s sleek kind of modernity being largely a ring road and a motorway.
Nobody said the word brutalist yet, I'm surprised.
Well, they're sort of brutalist, yeah. I mean, Holford's Paternoster Square is quite brutalist.
Or just brutal.
Yeah, or just brutal, yeah.
By the way, listener, I should apologise, but only half-heartedly, for the wind going into the microphone at the moment. You tried recording a podcast on a bridge in high wind.
Should you walk over and maybe go to the steps, or maybe a little bit more shade?
Well, anywhere with warmth really is starting to seem quite attractive. Yeah. I'll do a little trailer here, a bit of a teaser. We're going up one of the most notable tool structures in London in an episode fairly soon. And it's going to be similarly windy. Well, we're crossing over the bridge now.
And to our left is Tower Bridge, which when it was originally erected, and it's actually only from the 1890s. Tower Bridge was really it's a spring chicken of a bridge in relation even to Rennie's Bridge, and at the time was considered something of a folly and described as being a kind of gimcrack of cod gothicism, as it were.
That's a sentence that rolls off the tongue.
Exactly, yeah. No, it didn't.
I've never really warmed to it. It's terribly fussy, isn't it?
It's busy. I mean, there was a plan to encase... I mean, again, these great plans. There was a plan at one point to encase the bridge in glass.
Really?
Tower Bridge, this is. And convert some elements of it into housing. But that also floundered. So.
Yeah, that would seem sort of structurally dangerous as well. Although it might have sorted out this podcast. I don't know. There we go, some of the port buildings off to our left there. I particularly like the Hayes Wharf one, yeah. Which seems to me to have something of 1910 about it.
It does. It's quite kind of deco, isn't it, in its design?
Yeah, almost pre-deco, yeah.
Yeah. Nouveau, perhaps, is that it?
Oh, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
So let's get down to business then. We've got the desire for a new bridge. We know that this one's got to be replaced. What happens next?
Well, first off, the William Holt. I mean, William Holt is actually the architectural consultant on the plan. The design for almost the engineering work that the new London Bridge, the one we're walking on now, was done by a man called Michael Leeming.
So, which name do we attach to this bridge?
It's probably Holford, really. I mean, Leeming was working for the particular firm that built it, and he did the hard engineering of it.
He did a tower in Pisa, didn't he?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't know, maybe.
He didn't get my joke.
Oh, sorry, right. Leeming, not Leeming.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The contract is awarded and work begins on the new London Bridge in 1967. Now, entering the fray at this moment is a member of the Bridge House Estates Committee, who is a character called Ivan... or Frankie Luckin. Now, Ivan Luckin, or Frankie Luckin, was a former city correspondent for The Telegraph and worked in kind of press and publicity before entering into city politics. Now, he is the person who comes up with the idea of selling Rennie's London Bridge. And initially... many of his other city councillors and committee members are none too impressed by this idea.
Yes, who would want to buy a bridge?
Exactly. In fact, the exact phrasing used was, who do you think would pay money for a heap of old stones? And Luckin argued that he thought someone would buy it, and also he argued that he thought he could probably get £1 million. For these heap of old stones.
Well, where did this confidence come from on Luckin's part?
Well, I mean, Luckin was, it's a larger-than-life character, shall we say. Luckin was also a huge admirer of, as an old newspaper man himself, he was a huge admirer of William Randolph Hearst, who was the model for Orson Welles' Citizen Kane. Now, Hearst was a great scooper-upper of architectural treasures from around the globe, including some from Britain. And actually, the Society for the Protection of Ancient Buildings once ran a tube poster campaign warning people about Hearst's activities and demanding him to cease buying up old buildings. He bought a kind of medieval tithe barn from Wiltshire and had it shipped out to his place in Northern California. So Hearst, in a way, Luckin had a Hearst-like character in mind. Mm. I mean, during this period as well, you have things like the Queen Mary, the ocean liner, is also sold and shipped out to California, to Long Beach, to become a floating museum. And also the ruined Wren Church, St. Mary Aldermanbury, is taken apart and shipped out to Fulton, Missouri, as part of a kind of war memorial thing. Fulton, Missouri is also where Winston Churchill made the famous Iron Curtain speech. And this was just after Churchill's death. So there was a precedent, in a way, a few precedents for the idea of Americans buying, you know, bits of British kit and then kind of shipping them out and turning them into something else. And Luckin certainly thought that the buyer would be an American. Though there was a genuine concern, in a way, about who might buy the bridge among the Corporation of London. And one of the idea of the favoured bidders for this was possibly a Commonwealth country, either Australia or Canada. But in the end...
So we're sort of keeping it in the family.
Keeping it in the family, exactly. Right. Yeah, I mean, there's a piece in The Guardian when the sale is announced... or the bidding for the sale is announced, where it's suggesting, you know, that London, Ontario would be a good place for it to go. So in the end, Luckin launches this campaign for to put London Bridge up for sale. He creates this wonderful brochure, which is has folding bits, and it charts the history of London Bridge. And it doesn't just chart the history of the bridge, the 1831 Rennie Bridge. It traces it right back to the Romans and moves through, you know, 1,000 glorious years of British history of the bridge. So, you know, the booklet has lots of, you know, heads on sticks, monarchs, you know, peasants' revolts, you name it. Has all this history. And that, in a way, is Luckin's thing. He sells it. Not as a lump of old stone from 1831, half of the stone actually being from 1902, when it was widened. He sells it as a chunk of British history, and that is what he, you know, offers to the world for them to buy.
The rain has started to pick up as we've been recording. We're going to scramble for shelter. There's a likely-looking building with a nice big porch
going
on the left-hand side.
We should probably go over the other side.
Oh, you want us over there?
Well, and go down to the. We're walking now towards, in a way, the remaining archway of the Rennie Bridge, the bit that didn't go to America. So if we go across over here, we can go down to the what are called the Nancy Steps, because they appear in Charles Dickens' Oliver Twist.
So good. Okay, so you're tying us in here with a talk, very popular episode, I've got to say, that we did with John Smallshaw a couple of weeks ago. And he, in passing, well, he mentioned the Nancy Steps, and in passing he said, ha-ha, we didn't sell this bit to America. So now I'm starting to get some context here. We've swindled America, haven't we?
Well, by leaving them some steps behind. I think that... So we're now walking down into one of the remaining archways, or down these steps, which are referred to as the Nancy Steps from their appearance in Oliver Twist. And in that novel, it's brand new at that point. The dating of the novel is a new bridge. It's where, in a way, the kind of badlands of Southwark interact with the civilized city, where kind of Nancy. This is a point of exchange between those the criminal class and the kind of civil class, the world of Sykes, and the borough meets, you know, the gentry, with their Clerkenwell Green bookshops and so on.
And down we come on the Jubilee walkway. And here we go, we're in the archway beneath the bridge.
And we can just upstairs we have the London Bridge Experience, which has an array of heads on spikes, which seems the only experience of London Bridge is to be either kind of slaughtered or stuck on a spike.
A true London Bridge experience, if they're talking about the old London Bridge, would be to sort of be stuck in traffic.
Except for hours, yeah. But there were pubs on the bridge, so you could have taverns on the bridge, so you could have had a drink there. And there's a tavern here to the left of us as well, inside the remaining Rennie Archway, the Mughouse Pub, which is encased in here.
Well, now we don't have as long left on the clock as we could, because it's always a rich fund of stories and ideas and details, and it sort of, as you say, it kind of encapsulates the history of London in so many ways. We've got to get down to the character who bought this bridge.
So Ivan Lucchino offers the bridge up for sale, and the people who eventually put in the winning bid are a couple of, charismatic characters. You know, they're two American businessmen, and they are Robert Paxton McCulloch, who is an oil tycoon. He is also the inventor of the one-person operated chainsaw, McCulloch chainsaws, that's made a lot of his money out of that. He also invents the Paxton supercharger, which is a kind of a thing fitted to souped-up cars. So he's a lively figure. He also invests in property, and his business partner is a man called C.V. Wood Jr., or Cornelius Vanderbilt Wood Jr.
Could these guys sound any more American?
Well, exactly. And C.V. Wood was a former theme park designer. He'd had a hand in Disneyland, and also had been behind a theme park called Freedom Land, which was built on the Pelham Bay rubbish dump, and was a kind of a sort of journey through rides through American history, which is a bit of a flop, unfortunately, for him. But by the middle 60s, Wood and McCulloch, as part of this McCulloch Incorporated, are in the process of building an entirely new city out in a place called Lake Havasu. Now, before 1948, there is no Lake Havasu. It's only with the creation of Parker.
Did they buy that from somewhere else?
Basically, it's the creation of the Parker Dam, which on the Colorado River, which creates Lake Havasu. And McCulloch has an outboard motor company, and he wants to have a test site for that. So he establishes a test site out on Lake Havasu in the early 60s, and then decides, hey, why don't I just relocate my chainsaw plant out there as well and build an entire new city. So from 1963, he starts building this entire new city, which is called Lake Havasu City. It's going quite well. The idea is it's going to have light industry, but because of the lake, it's going to have fishing, and it'll be like a leisure resort. Plots are selling pretty well, but it's a bit sluggish. And C.V. Wood hears that London Bridge is for sale, and he persuades McCulloch that they should buy London Bridge, make it like a tourist attraction, the centre of this new resort city. And that's what they do. So in 1968, they become the proud owners of René's London Bridge, which they then have 10,000 tonnes of its brickwork, or its stonework, its granite, shipped out to Lake Havasu.
And they number all the bits, don't they, and sort of reassemble it.
Yes, there was actually a 17-year-old apprentice called Alan Sains, who I somehow tracked down. Various people have tracked him to look for him, so if he's out there listening, we'd love to hear from you, whose job it was to number the stones.
No, they got the intern to do it.
Practically, yeah. Well, in those these are more noble days of labouring, so at least he was on a wage as an apprentice. But McCulloch is slightly unhappy with the speed with which a lot of this is happening, so he sacks the British firm and employs a Swedish company who are at the forefront of containerisation to ship the stones out to America. So in a way, that's rather a sad chapter, because at this point is when the London docks are starting to close down. So again, there's a circle here in the story. René's London Bridge is built at a point when the docks are coming into their own, and René himself was the designer behind several of London docks. And then by the time his bridge is being taken apart and flogged off to America is also when those docks are closing down. So there's a nice kind of poignancy. And also there's another thing, in a way, that the idea of freight being a kind of river, the river being a passage for freight, is also being superseded by the idea of long-distance lorries and that taking over.
We're in the final minutes of this podcast, and there is nothing that I want to do more at this point than dig into that controversy around whether he got the right bridge, whether he intended to. You've got your theory about this.
I do. I mean, I looked long and hard at all the information I could find. I've delved through various archives and looked through various city documents. There are two things, really. One is Luckin produced this incredible
pamphlet, which also showed exactly what you were buying. It has a plan showing you exactly what you have to build. The thing about what they bought was that they bought 10,000 tons of the granite. As I've already said, the original bridge was 130,000 tons of granite. So what they really bought was the fascia. They bought the kind of outer edge of the bridge. And what is out in Lake Havasu City is the external brickwork over a frame. The frame actually was designed by Michael Leeming, who did the new London Bridge as well, the engineering of it. So in a sense, they had to know what they were buying, because you have to build a bridge in order to erect the bridge in the first place. I mean, their bridge was the London Bridge, when it was erected over in Lake Havasu, was actually erected on dry land. It was erected on a piece of desert, and then they dynamited a section through the lake to divert the water. So it was actually fantastic photographs of the bridge being erected on desert sand. So it's a lot easier to erect a bridge on dry land than it is when they're midway through a river. So that's another reason why it's extremely unlikely that they got the wrong bridge. That's not to say that in their initial approaches they thought they were after something else, but by the time they signed the deal and handed over the money, they had to know what they were buying.
So let me finally then ask where this scurrilous rumour has come from.
Well, I mean, there is a piece of archive footage or archive sound, which is an interview. I mean, I argue in the book that one possible source of the rumour, and really there's no, if you look back through old newspaper reports from the 60s, there's, you know, no one mentions Tower Bridge particularly. What does happen though is that McCulloch Jr., Robert Paxton McCulloch's son, gives an interview to the Today programme, and about the sale. He talks about, you know, what they're going to do, how they're going to erect it on dry land, and so on. And towards the end of the interview, Jack DeManio, the then presenter of the Today programme, just says, well, you know, have you got your eye on anything else, you know, Buckingham Palace or, you know, the Tower of London? And McCulloch Jr. sort of shoots back, and it's a light-hearted exchange. It's a kind of jokey, joshing exchange. Says, well, you know, I did ask Mr. King, who's the city engineer, about Tower Bridge, but he said he didn't want to sell. And if you imagine this is, you know, the Today programme, it's first thing in the morning, you know, it's you're shoving toast into your mouth, you're trying to get out for work, you've already heard this American tell you that he's going to erect London Bridge over dry land, and then you half-heartedly hear him say, oh, you know, I asked about Tower Bridge. Come opening time, that night, you know, all the pubs of London, everyone is saying, oh, you hear that thing on the radio, they're going to erect it over dry land, but they wanted Tower Bridge. You can imagine how that might blur. But also, you know, the bridge is sold at the height of, or towards the end, in a way, of swinging London mania, in a way. You know, you've got 1966, you know, the World Cup, you've got, you know, London is feeling very good about itself. By the time the new London Bridge is erected and by the early 70s, the economy is doing less good. You've got the ignominious defeat of Mexico in 1970. As a kind of endism, which has entered the British psyche after the heady days of the 60s. So you can see why maybe thinking you can, you know, cocking a snook at the Yanks might gain a bit more traction by that time.
Well, that's a very interesting angle. I mean, it goes without saying that's an interesting angle on an object that sits in amongst us all the time, and we pass over it. And I have to say, a lot of the focus is on the early end of its history, and it's been really refreshing finding out some of its more modern history. And I dare say that we could linger on the bridge that has existed since the end point of today's podcast, and there maybe there's a sequel there, I don't know. The book that you've got out at the moment is out in paperback now, as we mentioned, and where are you doing signings and talks?
I'm doing a talk on the 19th of February at Waterstones in Piccadilly, and I imagine some other ones after that too. But yeah, it's available in all good bookshops, some bad ones, but please try and buy it in a shop, as it were. So yeah, support London's independent shops as well.
Well said. Travis Elbrough, thanks very much.
A pleasure.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to my guest, Travis Elbrough. Thanks to Bernie Barkley and Mark Barr. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm in Quentin Wolfe.
sights, the sounds. You ain't never seen the light before. Just a stone's throw from your front door.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.